Welcome back, everyone, to the deep dive. As you know, we love picking a topic and really getting into it.
Really going deep.
Yeah, exactly. Today, we're diving into a pretty foundational and, to be honest, intensely dramatic chapter in American history.
Yeah.
The lead up to and the Civil War itself.
Right.
But specifically, we're going to be looking at how anti-slavery sentiment evolved into real movements, how it got institutionalized, and the incredibly varied and, I gotta say, fascinating responses from different Christian denominations as they wrestled with slavery.
Right.
Now, you, our listeners, you've sent us some truly thought-provoking sources on this, and we're going to unpack the key insights from those to give you a clearer and hopefully engaging understanding of this complex period, with a special focus on the role of religious institutions.
Absolutely.
Because, as we'll see, they're right at the heart of the story.
Front and center.
Yeah, front and center.
It's striking how what we see in this period is, you know, a growing unease about slavery really transforming into this organized opposition.
Yeah.
And we see those sparks early on. You know, the Quakers, for example, taking a firm stance against slavery around 1775, you know, setting a real early marker.
Yeah.
Then you have the Methodists and that Christmas conference in 1784, where they basically said, hey, our members, they shouldn't own slaves.
You know, it's interesting because when you see something like that, you think, wow, they were really ahead of the curve. It suggests a widespread moral discomfort. But then we look at someone like Jonathan Edwards, this huge figure in early American religious thought, right in the 1770s.
Yeah.
Edwards himself owned slaves.
Right.
It's complex, yet at the same time, you have his followers. Those Edwardsian preachers, they were some of the early voices actually opposing slavery. So even within these influential religious circles, there's this internal tension, a real push and pull.
Absolutely. And it's crucial to grasp that internal tension.
Yeah.
If we kind of zoom out to the bigger picture, you can look at the American Colonization Society, founded in 1817. Now, their aim was relocating free black people to Africa. Now, obviously, it ultimately failed.
It did.
And, you know, it reflects the racial biases of the time. But it does show a significant shift.
In what way?
It indicates a growing recognition that, okay, slavery's a problem. Even if the solution they offered, you know, was really flawed.
Right.
And didn't address the core issue of racial equality and integration within American society. It's like, okay, we know this is bad, but we don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, it's like kicking the can down the road a little bit.
In a way...
Who do you think was drawn to this idea at the time?
That's a good question. It seems like it probably appealed to folks who felt uneasy about slavery, but couldn't quite wrap their heads around a multiracial society.
Yeah, like they're somewhere in the middle.
In the middle ground, yeah.
But then, boom, we see this real departure with Oberlin College, founded in 1835.
Right.
This is a huge turning point, I think, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, yeah, big time.
It was the first college in the U.S. to admit both men and women. But even more importantly for our dive here, it was founded explicitly as an abolitionist institution. And later on, you have Charles Grandison Finney, you know, this renowned evangelist. He becomes associated with Oberlin.
Right.
And really solidifies its place as a center for, you know, abolitionist thought and action.
Yeah.
What impact do you think this kind of institutional commitment had on the movement as a whole?
Well, I think Oberlin really shows that you're moving from individual voices to this established, you know, educational institution.
Yeah.
And it's dedicated to abolitionism. So it shows a deepening and broadening of the movement, you know.
It's not just talk anymore.
Exactly. It's about educating future leaders, shaping thinkers with abolitionist values.
Yeah.
So it gave them this platform, you know, to develop.
Right.
And spread those arguments against slavery far and wide.
And then... Right. Enter William Lloyd Garrison. He really changed the game.
Yes, he did.
Now, Garrison, he trained as a printer's apprentice in New Jersey under a Quaker abolitionist. And that printing background becomes super influential.
It does.
He ends up in Boston and on January 1st, 1831, launches his abolitionist newspaper, The Public Liberator and Journal of the Times. And this was no moderate voice. He was absolutely unwavering in his demand for the immediate abolition of slavery.
What's compromise?
No compromises.
This is key. Garrison, he was not interested in gradual solutions. Political maneuvering. His call for immediate abolition was radical.
Yeah.
Confrontational.
It really shook things up.
It forced people to really confront the moral urgency in a way that those more moderate approaches hadn't.
But here's where it gets complex. Garrison was a profoundly divisive figure. People were either fiercely for him or vehemently against him.
Right.
His language was so strong, his criticisms of the church, and even other abolitionists who didn't fully agree with his tactics, caused real divisions in the anti-slavery movement. Makes you wonder, right? Is it sometimes necessary to have this kind of uncompromising, you know, even polarizing figure to shake things up and push for that radical change, mm-hmm. even if it means alienating some potential allies along the way?
That is such an important question. History shows us, you know, again and again, that those who challenge the status quo, mm-hmm. they can drive change.
Yeah.
And even if their methods are debated, their impact on public opinion and driving change is often undeniable.
Okay, so we've seen the rise of anti-slavery sentiment really reaching a peak with Garrison's powerful voice. Now let's look at how this issue tore apart American churches, major denominations, the Methodists, Baptists, and Presbyterians all experienced huge splits.
Now, those divisions within the church really underscore how deeply entrenched and morally conflicting the issue of slavery was. It wasn't just politics or economics. This struck at the very heart of their beliefs. Their sense of community and identity.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's start with the Methodists.
Yeah.
And we talked about John Wesley and his really strong condemnation of slavery as the villainy of villainies.
Right.
And that initial stance against slave ownership at the 1784 Christmas conference. But then, as our sources point out, we see this gradual creep, you know,
yeah.
of some Methodists starting to own slaves. And this created a ton of internal conflict. Why do you think that initial strong stance started to erode?
Well, it's probably a lot of factors.
Yeah.
You know, as Methodism spread, particularly down south,
yeah.
they ran into these entrenched economic systems and social norms.
Built around slavery.
Built around slavery.
Yeah.
You got it. The pressures of the plantation system, coupled with those prevailing racial ideologies,
yeah.
probably led some Methodists to, you know, rationalize, compromise their earlier anti-slavery convictions. And so you get this growing tension
yeah.
between the official stance and, you know, what some members were actually doing.
A real disconnect.
Yeah, a big one.
And then along comes Orange Scott. Such a great name.
I know, right?
He was so against this shift that in 1843, he leads this breakaway movement and forms the Wesleyan Methodist Church, where slave ownership was forbidden. This is the first significant fracture that we see.
Right. And the formation of the Wesleyan Methodist Church was really a principled stand against what Scott and his followers saw as a dangerous compromise.
Within the larger Methodist Episcopal Church,
exactly.
they wanted to reaffirm those original anti-slavery beliefs.
Yeah.
But the really major split comes in 1844 on the trigger. A bishop in the Methodist Episcopal Church owning slaves, this led to a massive debate and ultimately a formal and really painful division.
It was.
The northern churches became the Methodist Episcopal Church, which prohibited slave ownership, while the southern churches formed the Methodist Episcopal Church South, where it was allowed. What do you think was the lasting impact of this kind of denominational split?
Well, this geographical division within Methodism
right.
really mirrored the broader sectional divide, you know, in the nation.
Yeah.
And to this day, you can still find churches in the South with Methodist Episcopal Church South, you know, on the building.
Wow.
It's a tangible reminder of this historical rupture.
Yeah, you can see it. It
shows how deeply ingrained those divisions became.
Yeah, absolutely. It's history you can still see. Now let's shift to the Baptists.
Okay.
They also experienced a major split in 1844, the same year as the Methodists, the central issue here. Whether Baptist missionaries serving in Alabama could own slaves.
Right. So again, the question is slave ownership compatible with Christian ministry?
Yeah.
With church membership.
Mm-hmm.
And this issue of missionaries being slaveholders, it brought those contradictions front and center.
Yeah.
And the denomination had to take a side.
And the result was a formal division. In 1845, the Southern Baptist Convention was formed based on the principle that Baptists could hold slaves.
Right.
It's a sobering thought.
It is.
And what's interesting is that our sources mention within the last 5 or 6 years, there have been discussions within the Southern Baptist Convention
really?
About changing their name. Because of that association with slavery,
yeah.
and because their membership is now much more geographically diverse, ultimately they decided to keep the name.
They did.
But the fact that it was even debated
yeah.
speaks volumes about the weight of that history.
Yeah, that recent debate within the Southern Baptist Convention shows that the historical stance on slavery, it's still significant and a really sensitive issue. You know, it shows that religious institutions are still grappling with the past and its impact on the present.
Absolutely. Lastly, let's look at the Presbyterians.
Okay.
Their major split came later. Towards the end of the Civil War in 1864, they formed the Presbyterian Church in the USA in the North. and the Presbyterian Church in the United States in the South, with different positions on slaveholding.
Right.
And Presbyterianism, you know, has seen further mergers and changes since then.
They have.
What do you think we can learn from the timing of their split compared to the Methodists and Baptists?
Well, the fact that it happened later, closer to the end of the Civil War, might suggest that those tensions over slavery were there. But other theological or regional differences might have been more prominent at first. However, as the war progressed, the moral dimensions of slavery became so pronounced that it became the breaking point for them, too.
Yeah.
Shows that no major Protestant denomination could avoid this fracture.
So we've seen how deeply slavery divided these major denominations. But what about those that stayed unified? Remarkably unified in the face of this incredibly contentious issue.
It is remarkable.
Our sources point to the Congregationalists, Lutherans, Episcopalians, and Roman Catholics. What allowed them to stay together when others were splitting apart so dramatically?
Well, the reasons varied quite a bit.
Yeah.
For the Congregationalists, their location mainly in the North, especially New England, really played a role. They had strong anti-slavery sentiment in that region, so there wasn't as much pressure to split.
It was almost a unity of place, leading to a unity of opinion.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Now, the Lutherans took a different approach, really rooted in their theology. Can you explain that?
Sure. Martin Luther's two governments theology. It basically separates the church's role in governing spiritual life and the state's role in governing civic affairs. And this led many Lutherans to see slavery as a political issue, not a church doctrine issue. So it was up to the state.
Interesting. So they kind of sidestepped it?
In a way, yeah. Individual Lutheran groups could make their own decisions.
Yeah.
Without causing a national split.
They localized it.
They did.
The Episcopalians, interestingly, also allowed for local decisions on slavery, but they didn't have that same theological framework as the Lutherans.
Right. It was more pragmatic. Plus, there's the influence of the Oxford movement in England.
Okay.
Which was this Anglican movement back towards Catholic traditions.
Yeah.
And this might have, you know, to some extent, diverted some American Episcopalians from the slavery debate. Like the Church of the Advent in Boston with its high church practices. They were focused on something else.
So different theological currents influencing how they navigated this.
Absolutely.
Now, what about the Roman Catholic Church? They stayed unified, too. But their situation seems even more complex.
It was complex. Pope Gregory the Sixth had officially condemned the slave trade. So that set an anti-slavery position for the church globally. But in the U.S., Archbishop Francis Kenrick of Baltimore took a more pragmatic approach. He wanted to keep the American Catholic Church unified.
Yeah, because you had Catholics on both sides of the issue.
You got it. So he allowed both abolitionist and slaveholding Catholics to stay in the church.
It's almost like a strategic coexistence.
It was. You could say that.
And our source mentions this idea among some Catholics of a due process of law ultimately resolving it.
Right.
Like they believed in a gradual legal solution, rather than the church demanding immediate abolition. And it seems that did help them reconcile after the war.
More smoothly than those Protestant denominations that had split.
Now, our source brings up a question that I bet you're thinking too. What were the justifications, the theological justifications, for those churches that permitted slavery?
Ah, good question.
It seems so counterintuitive to us today.
It does. Those who allowed slaveholding often look to the New Testament, where slavery isn't explicitly abolished. They focused on passages about masters and slaves, and they interpreted them as regulating slavery, not condemning it.
So a very different reading.
Totally different from the abolitionist view, which emphasized love, justice, human dignity as incompatible with slavery.
Right. It's amazing how the same text can be used to support such opposing views.
It is.
And our source gives this example of Charles Strait Church in Boston, an abolitionist church. But they still practiced segregation.
Wow.
Which eventually led to the formation of the first integrated church, Tremont Temple Baptist Church. So even opposing slavery didn't mean embracing full racial equality.
It shows how deep racial prejudice was.
Even among those who saw slavery as wrong.
It was a long road to equality.
Okay, so the nation is moving towards civil war. Where do religious allegiances generally fall?
Well, unsurprisingly, geography was the main factor.
Mm-hmm.
In the North, ministers encouraged their congregations to fight, often framing it as a moral duty.
To end slavery.
To end slavery and preserve the nation.
In the South, they rallied behind the Confederacy, defending slavery and states' rights. And they found biblical justifications for it. It's hard to imagine that both sides believed they had God on their side, praying for victory. Our source talks about a Southern prayer asking God to lay thou their legions low. and the Northern Battle Hymn of the Republic, both sides using faith to fuel their cause.
Exactly. And the Battle Hymn of the Republic, you know, it's got these lyrics that can be interpreted in different ways. It reflects the emotions of the time.
Yeah. And afterwards, reconciliation was anything but easy.
It was hard.
The North saw the South as needing to be, you know, evangelized.
Reformed.
Reformed. While the South resented the North's actions on slavery.
It was deep.
Deep wounds, yeah.
Those different perspectives on the war created huge obstacles to reconciliation. The North feeling morally superior. The South feeling they fought for a just cause.
It's hard to bridge that gap.
It is.
Now, our source says that the story of the Black Church deserves its own deep dive.
It does.
We'll do that in the future. But we do see its beginnings in this period.
Yeah.
So how did the North and South interpret the war religiously?
Well, in the South, they often saw it as Northern aggression and prayed for retribution. In the North, it was seen as a fight against rebellion, a war to end slavery. And the North's victory was seen as God's judgment on the South.
So again, these contrasting views, each side thinking they were right. But our source highlights a more nuanced view. Lincoln's view.
Yeah.
He was so humble and recognized the complexity of it all. He often spoke with less certainty about God's specific will, acknowledged the messiness of history, and urged self-reflection. He questioned his own side's moral purity.
He was ahead of his time.
Yeah, a much more mature understanding of events. The idea that the war could be a learning experience for everyone, potentially leading to repentance, recognizing sin, and reconciliation.
It's a powerful thought.
This perspective is captured in a quote from our source. They describe the war as a divine act of judgment for the collective guilt, a sacrificial and cleansing tragedy, but with potential for national preservation and spiritual regeneration. And these principles are relevant even today when understanding conflict.
Absolutely.
It's about moving beyond blame and seeking deeper understanding.
Right.
Now, before we wrap up, let's talk about the early formation of the Black Church. The origins of the Black Church are tied to these divisions and prejudices.
They are.
Within Methodism, the first independent Black denomination was the African Methodist Episcopal Church.
The AME Church.
The AME Church. It was established in Philadelphia in 1816, but its roots go back further.
They do.
And the reasons for its formation are really telling.
Tell us.
Even in a northern city like Philadelphia, Black Methodists faced discrimination, prejudice, from white Methodists. This exclusion led them to create their own spaces for worship, fellowship, spiritual expression.
They needed their own space.
Richard Allen was key in this movement.
He was.
He helped found the AME Church, became its first bishop. Before that, he established Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Philadelphia, which led to the larger denomination. And it's significant that Francis Asbury, this major figure in Methodism, ordained Richard Allen. It shows a recognition of Black leadership.
Yeah, it was an important step.
Yeah.
The AME Church grew so much.
It did.
By 1860, there were about 22,000 members.
Wow.
And by 1896, nearly 500,000.
That's huge. It shows how vital it was for Black Americans.
It wasn't just about religion. It was about community.
Yeah.
Education.
Yeah.
Activism.
They also established the first Black magazine.
Yeah.
And the first university for Black people in America.
Wow. They did so much.
So we've covered a lot today.
We have.
The rise of anti-slavery sentiment, the divisions in Christian denominations, the churches that stayed unified, and the different interpretations of the Civil War, plus the early Black church.
It's complicated.
It is. It's not a simple story.
And by looking at these perspectives, we get a much richer understanding of this period.
And it's not just history. It's still relevant today.
It is.
So here's a thought for you, our listener. How does understanding this period inform your perspective on today's challenges and the role of faith in them? Think about what we've discussed and maybe explore the history of your own denomination. Thanks for joining us.
It's been great.